it formed? What does it do? So this cross-section, as you look at it here, you can see the vertebral body. The spinal cord will be normally here. This is the vertebral body. So here, you have all the abdominal context right here. Okay, so this is anterior. This is posterior. So then when you look at it here in the cross-section, you can see it has origin from the spinous processes. And so here, it has a posterior layer. And it has continuing on, having attachment to the transverse process here and forming a middle layer and continues on, comes to the anterior part here. And so this is the anterior layer of the thoracolumbar fascia. And which is this muscle that is sitting, very thick, big muscle in the abdomen next to the vertebral body, is taking origin from T12 to L3, 2, 3, 4, somewhere. There's a thick, big muscle you've seen in the first quarter when you were looking at the front of the thigh.
Psoas major.
So here is your psoas major muscle. Okay? And so it is covering that fascia, continuing on here. You can see it's covering the psoas major. And look at all the others. Latissimus dorsi here. Latissimus dorsi here has, its aponeurosis here. And then latissimus dorsi, the muscle itself is here. And when you also have all the other muscles here, the transversus abdominis muscle here, transversus abdominis muscle. And the internal oblique. Internal oblique in green color here, internal oblique. Look how far that comes. And then we have the external oblique. External oblique is not forming it. External oblique doesn't reach that far. But the transversus abdominis and the internal oblique, both of them have attachment to thoracolumbar fascia. Okay? And so now you can see when muscles go into spasm, at the back, how your patients can also have, some discomfort coming from the back to the front, because of the transversus abdominis muscle and the internal oblique muscle of the abdomen having attachment to the thoracolumbar fascia. And I don't think anybody is going to ask a question on the thoracolumbar fascia on a board exam. But of course, that doesn't prevent me from asking, isn't it? Or in the reception lab. Or in the reception lab. Because when you're massaging people's bodies, when you're doing acupuncture for muscle spasms and things like that, you need to know the direction of these muscle fibers, from where they're coming, where they're going. That is the main reason why you're looking at it. For massaging and, acupuncture treatments and, things like that. And so that is the thoracolumbar fascia. Inguinal ligament, we have gone over the inguinal ligament yesterday, but just like to finalize it. And there are a few names that I have included there. Again, I don't expect you to get worried about these names. The reason is, why I put this here, inguinal ligament, to what structure, to what muscle does the inguinal ligament belong to? The external oblique aponeurosis. The external oblique aponeurosis. Okay? And so the inguinal ligament is a part of the external oblique upper. This is the one. Okay, external oblique aponeurosis. Then we see that extends from the pubic tubercle to the SIF. Now then you see here, lacunar ligament, pectineal ligament. Again, this is not for board exam questions. I have put those two names there. They are both parts of the inguinal ligament. They are both parts of the inguinal ligament. So we have just heard about it. Okay, that's all. And so here, as you look at it, pectineal
can you give it? Where would you put that part of the inner ligament? Pectineal ligament. Pectineal line. So that part of the inguinal ligament that it is coming down on its way to the pubic tubercle, when it's coming down, you know, the pectineal line, that part of the inguinal ligament that is right on the pectineal ligament is the pectineal ligament. It's part of the inguinal ligament. The same thing with the lacunar ligament. Lacunar ligament is inside here. That means, you know, the lacuna. What is lacuna? What is the space? It's lacuna. Remember the chondrocytes? You know, the space. You know, that the chondrocytes are there. That's the lacuna space. So that space, that part of the inguinal ligament that is coming over this space here is what you call, see here, the lacunar ligament, and this is the space here. And this space is kind of part of, continuing on, you know, when you have, you know, this is the superficial inguinal ring, and so that is the space here. Again, what should a physician know? The physician should know, if you are in the operating room, you know, doing herniography, repair of the hernia, or something like that, is the time you may have heard this name that's going to be useful. Lacunar ligament, pectineal ligament are both parts of the inguinal ligament. Okay, that's all you need to know. And then deep inguinal ring, what is it an opening in? Deep inguinal ring, what is it an opening in? And the transversalis, L-I-S, transversalis fascia, lis fascia, okay? Transversalis fascia. As you look at this one here that will show you deep inguinal ring. So here we have the transversalis fascia, this is the peritoneum, extraperitoneal pad, transversalis fascia, and look at the opening from here into here, that is the deep inguinal ring. And so deep inguinal ring and superficial inguinal ring is here. So that these two, you know, openings, you know, are connected by this inguinal canal. We'll be studying this part of the body again. Descent of the testes and ovaries and all kinds of things, we'll be looking at this quarter. Now, this inguinal canal, what does it transmit? For the time being, the inguinal canal transmits in the male spermatic cord, in the female, the round ligament of the uterus. So that is what is being, you know, is transmitted in the inguinal canal. Spermatic cord in the male, round ligament of the uterus in the female, and the ilioinguinal nerve in both genders. We transmit ilioinguinal nerve, okay? And so, even though we haven't studied the inguinal canal in detail at this time, but anybody can ask you a question on, you know, such things, because I have mentioned it, what is being transmitted in the inguinal canal, okay? And so the nerve is the ilioinguinal. Yeah, nerve in both genders, you know, in female and in the male, along with the round ligament of the uterus and the spermatic cord, ilioinguinal nerve is also transmitted, you know, via the inguinal canal. And then, inguinal canal is down, and so there's the last bit that is here, is the vessels of the anterolateral abdominal wall. Vessels of the anterolateral abdominal wall, as you look at it here, you have the arteries, the veins, and so here, again, this is of interest to you as you look at this part here. Arteries. Here, looking at you. Subclavian, axillary. you have the femoral, and you also have the external iliac here. And as you're looking at it here, from the subclavian, what muscle is coming down here? What is this one here? You have descended it, you know it. Internal thoracic, internal thoracic. So looking at the internal thoracic comes here, have you seen it that it is dividing into muscular phrenic and a superior epigastric? Have you seen it? Okay, so here is the superior epigastric. Lying right here on this, the rectus abdominis muscle, and it is coming down here. And the muscular phrenic also on the lateral aspect coming down here. And then here you have the inferior epigastric coming up. What is it, a branch of the inferior epigastric? External iliac. So here is the inferior epigastric, and there is anastomosis here. Okay? And so what did you see by this anastomosis? That means, you know, the subclavian and the external, you know, iliac arteries. So the branches of these two major arteries have arterial anastomosis in the anterior abdominal wall. And not only one anastomosis, look at the branches going in anastomosing here. See here, the muscular phrenic coming down, branching, and this muscular phrenic also has anastomosis with the lower intercostals, the subcostal, and the lumbar arteries. The lumbar arteries belong to the abdominal aorta. The lumbar arteries are branches of the abdominal aorta. So in the anterior abdominal wall, on both sides here, you have extensive arterial anastomosis, you know, from branches of major vessels, major arteries, subclavian, external iliac, abdominal aorta, and all of those. And here, again, the circumflex iliac, deep circumflex iliac. Here is the deep circumflex iliac coming up. And deep circumflex iliac, what do you think it's a branch of? External iliac, exactly. Deep circumflex iliac is a branch of the external iliac. So is this one. And so this, you can see the beautiful anastomosis. Then there's also your superficial circumflex and your superficial epigastric. They're superficial, and you can see when from where they're coming. From where are they coming? The superficial circumflex iliac and all those piddly little things in this region. From where are they coming? Femoral. Yeah, you're right. Look at it. Look at the diagram. Femoral. So femoral gives branches. The external iliac gives branches, and there is anastomosis. That is the arterial supply to the anterior abdominal wall muscles. I don't think anybody expects you to know the specific blood supply, the specific vessel going to the specific muscle. The anterior abdominal wall, extensive anastomosis, the major vessels that are supplying branches here, I think that is what, if that much a physician knows, I will be very happy. And so then let's move on to the venous drainage here. Okay. So that is the arteries and the veins here, veins. Okay, the venous veins of the, okay, here venous drainage and the lymphatics. Okay, let's, okay, good. We're keeping good time here. Venous drainage, again, the same named veins. That means inferior epigastric, superior epigastric, muscular phrenic, and the whole lot, you know, that is here. But what is interesting here are two things. Number one, cutaneous venous drainage, that means superficial venous drainage from below the umbilicus. Is the umbilicus. From below the umbilicus, roughly like that, will go where? Huh? Great saphenous vein, excellent. Great saphenous vein. And the superficial venous drainage from above the umbilicus, from the anterior abdominal wall will go to where? The axillary vein. So it's going to the axillary vein. Now you can also see the extensive anastomosis, venous anastomosis here. And that venous anastomosis, extensive venous anastomosis, one of them you already know of, which is that one. Which is that one. Kaurako, yes, here it is. Kaurako Vigyastrik follows, you see, from above the umbilicus. First it's going into the Kaurako Vigyastrik, going into the lateral thoracic, going into the axillary vein. So if you have a blockage to the IVC, that is the IVC is traveling about here, you know, on the right side of the vertebral column, traveling up here. And so if there's a blockage to the IVC, venous blood that is supposed to pass in the IVC can rise up in any of or all of these veins. Any or all of these veins, even though normally the venous drain is from here down, is supposed to go into the base saphenous vein, but in such a blockage, the veins can rise up. I mean, venous blood can rise up into any of these. As a physician, if you're examining somebody's abdomen, even though they are not complaining, but you see when you take their clothes off, and when you're looking at their abdomen, if you see pronounced, enlarged veins in the abdomen, and they're not complaining to anything about it because they don't know. They think, ah, yeah, I have, you know, few blue lines. I don't know. My veins are showing. You know, maybe I've gone thin or something like that. They don't know. What can that be? It could be a tumor compressing on the inferior vena cava. It could be a tumor compressing on the inferior vena cava. Or anything like that. So your observation and your knowledge so will help you diagnose a case very early or late or whenever, but you will be able to diagnose it. And that is how it helps you clinically. And the other thing I'd like you to know, and I will not dwell on it but mention it here, there is venous anastomosis around the umbilicus. Venous anastomosis around the umbilicus, that is between the superficial umbilical veins, anastomosis around the umbilicus, anastomosis plural around the umbilicus. Between the superficial, yeah, superficial umbilical veins and the para umbilical veins that you will find in the falciform ligament. The falciform ligament connects the liver to the anterior abdominal wall. It connects the liver to the anterior abdominal wall. So paraumbilical veins in the round ligament of the liver, round ligament of the liver is in the falciform, you know, ligament. And that is, you know, important because this is another area where you have systemic veins, systemic venous anastomosis, and the portal venous anastomosis is taking place. What is the other place that we have mentioned in this quarter? The esophageal, the lower esophageal veins, anastomosing with the left gastric vein, the left gastric vein. So at that time I mentioned that there are four or five other places that have such anastomosis, and so this is the umbilical one. The veins you can see is anastomosing with the para-umbilical veins are in the falciform ligament. Para-umbilical, often people make a mistake when they hear the para-umbilical veins. Para-umbilical veins, they think is around the umbilicus. No, para-umbilical veins are in the falciform, you know, ligament. And that's about the veins, and so that brings me to the closure of this outline, that is the lymphatic drainage. Now, you know, one of the principles that you follow in anatomy is that when you see the veins going in one direction, the initial ones from below the umbilicus will go, you know, where? Superficial, inguinal lymph nodes. Superficial, thank you. Superficial, inguinal lymph nodes. So lymphatic drainage from the anterior and lateral abdominal wall from below the umbilicus would go into the superficial inguinal lymph nodes. Remember, the superficial inguinal lymph nodes are very important because they receive lymph from several areas. Open the first quadrant, several areas, okay. And then from above the umbilicus, where will the lymphatic drainage go to? Axillary lymph nodes. So I'm done with the anterior lateral abdominal wall. Do you have any questions on the anterior lateral abdominal wall? Yeah, there. The left gastric vein. Okay, since these are not, this is all done, now I can very comfortably move to the next outline, and perhaps you have seen, I sent you an email yesterday telling you that I have put a few outlines online, and also the heart, diagrams I put online, and so you can sit back and get those printed out. Okay, now let's go here to the next outline and finish up here. Alright. Next outline is the. Now you see how we are going and why we are going in this fashion. We have done the thorax, came to the abdomen. When we came to the abdomen, we noticed that it's not a good idea just to walk into the abdomen, but we should just see what is there, isn't it? So you just take a look and see, where you should step and where you should not step when you are walking, into a building or something like that. And so here, we saw the anterior abdominal wall. So we have looked at the anterior abdominal wall, finished it. The skin and the superficial fascia and the muscles and the arteries and the veins. And the nerves you've seen, nerves, I did not go over the nerves of the anterior abdominal wall, but that coloring packet you just, have had, not that one, the one that you have, the one you had yesterday, the front of that coloring packet that you had yesterday has the nerves of the anterior lateral abdominal wall. This one. See, that's a good, bit of information there. You can really see from where to where the nerves of the anterior lateral abdominal wall is coming. Why are they called thoracoabdominal nerves? Which ones are thoracoabdominal nerves? What are their positions? In neuroscience, in the spring quarter, when you go to test, the sensory, modalities on the abdominal wall and places like that, and they would stand there and they would ask you, level is this, which nerve, which thoracic nerve is here, what is the nerve ending here, which one and all that. So this diagram really helps, that was yesterday. Okay. This diagram really helps. And so then we come and we see that we've done the anterolateral abdominal wall. Now we come to look at the perineum. That means we walk into the abdomen. And when you walk into the abdomen, here, you have seen that we have, when we go through all this, we have peritoneum. What do you think is the peritoneum? What is the peritoneum? What is it made of? What kind of a tissue is the peritoneum? What did you say? Serous membrane. There are only two types of membranes in the body. What are they? You all had histology, didn't you? Whether you had it or not. What are the two types of membranes you will find in the human body? Mucus and serous. Mucus membrane and serous membrane. because you look at it here. So we will look at the peritoneum first, okay? And how many layers and where is it located? And you know, the peritoneal cavity and clinical relevance associated with the peritoneum and the peritoneal cavity. Then we will go and look at the subdivisions of the peritoneum. Subdivisions of the peritoneal cavity, okay? In the subdivisions, you will see there's a greater sac and there is a lesser sac. But greater sac itself, when you look at it, you have different subdivisions even there. Supramesocolic, inframesocolic, you know, all those. And then we will look at the each of these separately. That means separate compartments of the greater sac. Okay, these are still parts of the greater sac. Then we will look at the lesser sac. Okay, and then we will come and look at the omenta. Omenta, plural. Omentum, great omentum you might have heard of. Great omentum, lesser omentum. So then we will look at the omenta, their function, and you know, where are they, that we will, you know, look at. And then we would look at the relationship of, you know, the greater sac and the lesser sac, and also the peritoneal, you know, folds that are connecting the liver to the anterior abdominal wall, and the subphrenic spaces that belong, you know, to the peritoneal, you know, cavity. And then we will look at how the peritoneal pouches are formed in the male and in the female. Peritoneum as it is coming over the bladder, the uterus, you know, the rectum and all those, and how do they form the peritoneal pouches, and which peritoneal cavity is closed, the male peritoneal cavity or the female peritoneal cavity, and some of the clinical significances, that means potential size of internal herniation. And then as we go to finish it, we have, these are still the potential definitions, what is a mesentery, what is a peritoneal ligament, and on the anterior abdominal wall, on the inside, like if you cut open here, flip the anterior abdominal wall, and I show you my anterior abdominal wall like that, what would you see? You know, that is this part here. Peritoneal reflections over the structures on the inner surface of the anterior abdominal wall. And then the final, you know, thing here is the, those are those folds, and then the peritoneal structures, you know, that are retroperitoneal, intraperitoneal, primary retroperitoneal, secondary retroperitoneal. Why should a physician, you know about retroperitoneal, primary retroperitoneal, all those? And then we will look at the last bit. That is, I think that retroperitoneal lead is the last thing. And with the outline, you have seen that I have included a lot of the information. That means what is retroperitoneal, which structures are primary retroperitoneal, what are secondary retroperitoneal. That was with the outline, wasn't it, Maureen? With the last pages of the outline. Yeah, the definitions, okay. I thought I had included which ones are also, right? Okay, let me see, finding I should include. Let me see. Let me look at my identify primaries. No, that is the competencies. Before the competencies, okay, definitions of mesentery and all that we have there. And primary retroperitoneal structures, yeah, those are included there. The major retroperitoneal viscera, do you have that with your mind? Okay, yeah, Dr. Simon is shaking his head. Do you have that? If you don't, let me know. I'll put it on, because it's really very useful, you know, for you to know, because sometimes why would somebody go, you know, be in that spot, that one? Okay, so you have it. You have that. Okay, that is good. Now you have an idea as to, now you know why I wanted to take you through there, because there's greater sight, lesser sight, this, that, and everything here. Now let's go slowly and see each of these. The abdominal cavity boundaries, you already know yesterday, I have gone over it. And so today, the distended abdomen. As a physician, a woman comes into your office, or a man comes into your office and has a huge big point right here. And if you say a woman and childbearing age, what would you think? She's full-term pregnant, or she's close to somewhere there. So one of the causes is fetus. So protruding, distended abdomen, one of the causes of distended abdomen is fetus. The other is feces, fecal matter. Somebody can be constipated constantly and, you know, still keep eating, and, you know, it can be distended abdomen. And there's a few other things here that is flatus, gas. People get older. They have a problem passing. Many times they have a problem passing gas. And if gas really can bloat up like that, it can. And, you know, and you don't know until you just, you know, do that. You don't know whether it's gas or fluid. Fluid is another thing. Fluid means you can have intestinal obstruction from fluid not being able to pass. So 5 F's is called, okay? Fetus, fluid, feces, and flatus. And Dr. Moore also includes food. He also, I didn't include food, but he includes food. You know, that fat, you know, somebody has a lot of fat in the greater metric fat. So fat, fetus, flatus, feces, fluid, according to Dr. Moore, food also. And so that is the distended abdomen causes. So you as a physician can easily figure out, you know, what it is, you know, that your patient has. Now, after looking at all those, we go into the abdomen. We go into the abdomen. Now you've seen the muscles and everything, and you come across the peritoneum. And that peritoneum, you've already seen, it's a double-layered serous membrane. Double-layered serous membrane, just very much like the pleura, very much like the pleura. And if it is very much like the pleura, and if it is lining a cavity, what layer of the peritoneum is lining the abdominal cavity? Parietal layer, and as you may have that current packet with you, that was given out today. Okay, so I have mine here. Let me take one out. Let's color it, and so you can easily see where all this is, you know, going. Okay, good. space, and then continues on, and the visceral layer is just, you know, investing, you know, the viscera. Okay, those are the two layers of the retina. And so between these two layers, what do we have? The peritoneal cavity. The peritoneal cavity. The peritoneal cavity then has what? It's a serous membrane, serous fluid. How much? Very tiny, microliter, nanoliters of serous fluid in the peritoneal cavity, just like in the coronal cavity. And so if it's just like the coronal cavity, is it an anatomical space or a potential space? Potential space. It's a potential space. So if it's a potential space, does it have any, I'll come to your question in a minute, Katie. If it's a potential space, do you think it will have any viscera, any organs in it? No. So it doesn't have any organs, doesn't have any viscera? No, it doesn't. Things stick like into it like that, but not in it. Not in it. Katie, you had a question. The visceral peritoneum is that which is investing the viscera. Here, look at it here. This is, you know, all these are coils of the intestine cut parts. See here, to here, here, to here, like that, okay? It's a continuous membrane. It's a continuous membrane, okay? Pleura is a continuous membrane, so is this one. But that which is lining the body cavity is called the parietal pleura. I mean, the parietal peritoneum. That which is investing the viscera is the visceral peritoneum, okay? Yeah, we will go there. We will go there. I don't want to go there right now. Okay? No, she wants to know if this is going around the transverse colon, and I don't want to take you there right this time, but I will take you there. Okay, so that is visceral and parietal layer of the peritoneum. And then what do we have, you know, here? That is not three, that is two, you know, here. The other thing here is the peritoneal cavity. We have gone over this. Clinical relevance. Peritonitis, you already know what is peritonitis. What is peritonitis? Inflammation of the peritoneum. Inflammation of the peritoneum. But you may or may not know what is ascites. What is ascites? Increases. Accumulation. Accumulation of fluid. Just like pericardial effusion, just like pleural effusion, you know, ascites is increases of, you know, fluid in the peritoneal cavity. Ascites is increases of peritoneal fluid in the peritoneal cavity. That is ascites, okay? And so here, I'd like to dwell a minute on ascites because this is, you know, something that you may come across. What conditions can produce ascites? What conditions can produce ascites? What do you think of what can produce ascites? Anybody? Anything? Number one, cirrhosis of the liver. Cirrhosis of the liver. You know the spelling of cirrhosis of the liver.
Cirrhosis.
Yeah. She spelled it. Anybody? Cirrhosis of the C. You want me to write it? No, okay. Cirrhosis of the liver is one. And the other is peritonitis also. Peritonitis also can, you know, produce, you know, ascites. And the other that books may not show you is ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer. Because I talk to clinical people. Ovarian cancer. Now, I've mentioned it in class and I expect you to know. Ovarian cancer is one of the causes of ascites. Okay? And let me see what late stages of congestive cardiac failure, CHF. Late stages of CHF. So if somebody has ascites, what are the causes of ascites and why am I going over it? Because as a physician, you can immediately suspect and then you can continue your, you know, your chest. Ascites, you're right. Ovarian cancer, after liver, peritonitis. So any of these, and there can be, you know, others that I'm not, you know, aware of, can give you ascites. Okay. Now, next to that ascites, here I have written paracentesis. What do you think is paracentesis? Paracentesis? What is paracentesis? Yeah, removal. Removal. Paracentesis is when you remove, when you put that needle into the abdominal, meaning the, into the peritoneal cavity. So if you have excess fluid, ascites, and you have a protruding, you know, abdomen, fluid, remember? Protruding abdomen, one of the causes is fluid, ascites, fluid, okay? So in the linea alba, below the umbilicus, you could very safely put a needle, a wide needle with a cannula in it, and then you connect it, you know, to a tube and something to drain it. But it is monitored. They monitor the blood pressure of the person and everything, so they don't go into shock all of a sudden if you remove 2 liters of fluid from the body. You know, the person can go into shock, you know, so you don't do that. But, so paracentesis is when you remove the fluid, you know, excess fluid from the peritoneal cavity, okay? Thoracentesis, what will be thoracentesis? Removal of the fluid from the, or in case of the pleural effusion. In case of pleural effusion also, you can, you know, remove fluid like that, but very well trained people. That's why you need to know the, what do you call, the boundaries of, you know, this parietal peritoneum or parietal pleura and things like that. So that is why I have put paracentesis here. So when you hear about, somebody tells you, you will be working side by side with people who may do some of these things. And I'd like you to be aware of when they say, I'm going to do a paracentesis or I suggest a paracentesis for your patient, I'd like you to have heard it, and then you can look it up. And so, paracentesis, and now these are pathological things. In addition to all these, we can think of the use of the peritoneal cavity, and the peritoneal fluid. I think normal use. Normal use will be intraperitoneal injections. Intraperitoneal injections and intraperitoneal dialysis. Kidney dialysis can be hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis. Actually, kidney dialysis, when it began several, you know, decades ago, it was peritoneal dialysis. Then only it became hemodialysis, you know, the shunt and the thing. And so peritoneal dialysis, that is. And intraperitoneal injections, that is not dialysis, intraperitoneal injections, chemotherapy. People who are on chemotherapy, cancer patients on chemotherapy, and to avoid phlebitis from, you know, the chemical and also the needles, you know, repeated use of needles, to avoid that, some patients will adopt, you know, or agree to go on peritoneal, you know, introduction of chemotherapy. And the other intraperitoneal injections is anesthesia. That anesthesia part, especially for research animals. I've done extensive intraperitoneal injections for research animals. When I was doing research, I used to do that, intraperitoneal injections, you know, to anesthetize, you know, the animals before you do surgery on them. So intraperitoneal injections, for research purposes in animals, and I have not done it on humans. Okay? And so that is chemotherapy. So those are the good uses of peritoneal, you know, cavity and peritoneal, you know, fluid, and for our purposes. And then I have additions here. What do you understand when I say additions? Sticking at, you know, the parietal layer and the visceral layer of the peritoneum can be sticking to each other, so they can adhere to each other. You know, so here you can have the visceral layer here, the parietal layer here. These two can stick together. What can be the conditions and or the causes where you may expect to see adhesions? Surgical intervention, you know, abdominal, general surgery, abdominal surgery, where the surgeon has to go in and, you know, he may, you know, be moving, you know, the peritoneal, you know, membranes, and so handling of the peritoneal membranes can, you know, cause little later on adhesions. That means after following major surgery in the abdomen, you know, you can have, because you can have some, what you call, fibroblasts forming and form, you know, forming extra tissue between the two. And the viscera, you know, to the abdominal wall also can, and parietal to visceral, and so different kinds. What other causes can we expect? Surgical intervention and inactivity. In nursing homes, if you're seeing, you know, people, you know, that are really inactive, they are not really mobilizing themselves, inactivity, not in you or me, or people who are at least walking about and doing things. People who are really bedridden, and sometimes they may have some psychological problems, you know, emotional problems, and they're not aware of it, they don't get up. And this can, you know, that can happen, inactivity, surgical intervention, and let me see, those are the causes of adhesions. And there are some naturopathic measures that I didn't include. I thought I included it there. Naturopathic measures of treatment, colon therapy, and deep tissue work. But you have to be careful when you do deep tissue work. You're manipulating. That means you're physically separating these things that are sticking together. Deep tissue work. And your patient may develop some bleeding from it. So you need to. How do you know that you're, but that's what, and those are the two treatments that naturopaths do for adhesions when they suspect. Okay, colon therapy and deep tissue work are the two things. I don't do these things, so I can't explain it in detail. So you can figure out afterwards in your other training, okay? And when you get these things, then you figure out, associate the two together. And what else? Let me see. Oh, yes. Peritonitis, that means I did say infection can also cause adhesions, okay? Infection, surgery, inactivity are the three common causes of adhesions. Yes, Lily. Yeah, so Lily's question was, does that mean if there's adhesion, does that mean there is need of peritoneal fluid in the peritoneal cavity? At that place, there isn't. At that place, there isn't. Because what happens in adhesions is that extra tissue forms. Fibroblasts are one type of cells. I don't know if you've taken histology, fibroblasts and all kinds of different types of cells. Fibroblasts, you know how sticky they can be, you know how many processes they have. You know, they can really stick to, you know, many structures and, you know, begin, you know, some things, that's fibroblasts. And so fibroblasts are, you know, there. And then we come to, now we have looked at the peritoneum, the two layers, the peritoneal cavity, which is a potential cavity, what you have there, and the simple clinical relevance that I can think of, and then main divisions of the peritoneal cavity. And the peritoneal cavity, color here is your blue color, is your greater self. And as you look at the greater self, this is the liver. So that is the liver. What structure do you have right up here? What structure do you have right up here? What is the structure? The diaphragm. The diaphragm. So the greater sac then extends from the diaphragm all the way to the pelvic floor. All the way to the pelvic floor. As you know, this is the pelvis because here's the urinary bladder, here's the uterus, here's the rectum. And so you know that is the pelvis here, the pelvic floor. So all of this area here, that is, you know, covered here like that. So that is all the greater sac. Now, when we look at this greater sac, you can see the greater sac is further further divided into a supra mesacolic compartment and an infra mesacolic compartment. And you may remember, why do anatomists do all these divisions and subdivisions and imagine things and give imaginary lines and all that? Why do they do that? So we can discuss things easily about this, below that, and all those things. So this blue colored greater sac is further divided into a supra mesacolic compartment. What does mesacolon mean? From the word mesacolon. Mesacolon is, you know, the mesentery of the colon. Mesentery of the colon. And so this greater sac is subdivided into a supramesacolic compartment by the mesocolon that is here. This is the colon. See, this is the transverse colon. So here you have the mesocolon. Okay? And what else is subdividing it? So here, as you look at this outline, your outline here, the greater sac is further or subdivided by the greater omentum, the transverse colon, and the transverse mesocolon. So there are three things, greater omentum, transverse colon, and the transverse mesocolon. So transverse mesocolon, you have seen. So this greater sac, this blue area, is subdivided into a supramesacolic compartment by the transverse colon also. Transverse mesocolon you have seen, and so the transverse colon is sitting here, and the greater omentum here. Let me go over the greater omentum with you, as that is the first structure you will be coming across as a huge, big apron right in front of the all the abdominal, you know, viscera, greater omentum. Omentum. So here is the greater omentum, like an apron hanging down. This is the stomach. This is the greater curvature of the stomach. So it's extending from the greater curvature of the stomach. So if you take a sagittal section of this, you know, you will only see this part, isn't it? So that is what you're seeing here. So here is the greater omentum in purple. Let me see, a purple color. Yeah, purple is the color I haven't used here. Okay, yeah, purple color. Here is the greater omentum. So here is your stomach. And so here is the two layers of the greater omentum hanging down from the greater curvature of the stomach, going back up. Now, Katie, you had a question about transverse colon, transverse mesocolon. So here is that question being answered. That is, so here is the transverse colon. And so here, here is the double layer. It's a double layer here. Two layers here, two layers here. Those four layers are seen clearly in this diagram. That's the great tomentum. That's the sinusoidal section of the great tomentum here, dividing. This is the stomach. So here is the, from the great crevice of the stomach, here is the great tomentum. Anterior two layers, posterior two layers. It comes down, goes back up in front of the transverse colon, in front of the transverse mesocolon, and then it will be fusing, you know, with your, you know, parietal, you know, peritoneum, parietal peritoneum. And but what is interesting and what is interesting to me, but what is important here is the greater sac. That means, you know, the larger part of the peritoneal cavity is subdivided into a supra mesocolic compartment. Here is the mesocolon. So the supra mesocolic compartment is from above here up. Supra mesocolic compartment from above the transverse colon. And so here is the, and in this diagram, here is the transverse colon. And so here's the transverse colon, transverse mesocolon. And so here you have divided this. So what are the structures we have in the supra mesocolic compartment? What do you see there? The liver you see there, you see the neseromentum there. And so you can see you also have the pancreas there and the stomach there. So those are all the structures that you would find in the supra mesocolic, you know, compartment. You know, that's just for the description, just to figure out where things are, is why this compartment is divided and talked about, supra mesocolic compartment. And so if you know how to figure out the terminology here, above the mesocolon, the compartment in the greater sac, above the mesocolon, supra mesocolic compartment. It contains your stomach, it contains your lesser omentum, it contains your, you know, liver. Those are the, you know, structures that you would find in the pancreas also. Pancreas also is, you know, found in the supra. Here's the pancreas in the supra mesocolic compartment. Yeah. Great tomentum is related, it's not related, you don't talk about it as being either parietal or visceral. The great tomentum is a reflection of the largest fold of the peritoneum. The largest fold of the peritoneum, it is hanging from the stomach, but it is the largest fold of the peritoneum. That is how you discuss the great tomentum. It's not separate, it's a continuous membrane, but we don't talk about it because it's not, you know, investing in an organ, so you don't call it visceral, okay? And it's not lining the cavity, so you don't call it parietal. But what do you call it as? We call it as the largest fold or reflection of the peritoneum. That's how you define it. Yes? Yeah, it is a fold or reflection. Largest fold or largest reflection. It's like a sheet. It's like a sheet. The largest fold of the peritoneum that you will find is the great tomentum. And in reality, you would believe me, when you open up the abdominal cavity, this one never has not really done a good job of this. Who has done a good job of it? More than daddy. More than daddy has done a good job of a diagram, the best diagram so far of the great tomentum that I have seen is in your textbook, 237 or something like that. But this is the diagram. I've taken it from the textbook. If you've seen it, you can see what I mean. Look at it here. The all of you have questions about this, let's go here. Here, okay? So here we have the stomach. All right. And then here, of course, you have the ascending colon, transverse colon behind here, descending colon. And so here you have the spleen. And from the greater curvature of the stomach has a greater curvature and a lesser curvature. Curvature, like a curve. Okay? And from that greater curvature, you can see the apron hanging down like that and folding back up. And so you can see that hanging down part here. Here and folding back up. So then when you look at this diagram here, it shows you, but not as well as Dr. Moore has shown in the textbook there. So you can see the four layers of the retrovector, four layers of the retrovector. And also, it has a lot of clinical significance when I do the omenta, I will take you there. Okay, right now, I'm not doing the omenta, but this is just for you to understand. And those of you who have looked at the pictures in the textbook, you can, really, you have seen this diagram. I may not be giving the exact page number, but it is, somewhere there. So that we have looked at one of the subdivisions of the peritoneal cavity, that is the greater sac. The greater sac, has a supravesicolic compartment. And what structures do we have there? We have looked at the stomach and the liver and the lesser omentum and structures like that and the pancreas. Then we have an inframesocolic compartment. That means the compartment of the greater sac below the mesocolon, below the mesocolon. So here is the mesocolon. This red one here is the mesocolon. Remember, the mesocolon, when Vaishali asked me, measure mesocolon, remember I answered, what is mesocolon? The mesentery of the colon. The mesentery of the colon. And so, the inframesocolic compartment, that means below this, the mesocolon of the transverse colon, all, these structures that are here. And what structures do you think you have in the inframesocolic compartment? Let's come here and identify this, because this is what you will be seeing in this section. And as you look at it here, the transverse colon has been flipped up. So this is showing you the transverse mesocolon. This is what you're seeing here. This is transverse mesocolon. This is transverse mesocolon. So in the inframesocolic compartment, what structures do you see? All of the small intestine, that means all of the jejunum, all of the ileum, parts, only part of the duodenum, and everything else, and colon is cecum, colon. That means when you put it down, the transverse colon, the descending colon, all these, and the rectum, and everything else, below the transverse mesocolon, everything else is in the inframesocolic compartment. In the inframesocolic, compartment, okay? And then, when you look at the inframesocolic compartment, you have seen what structures, you have there. And what is the clinical thing? Why should you study this? You're not going to be doing major abdominal surgeries, but why should you then know this? The inframesocolic compartment, let's go and look at the clinical significance, whether you are a naturopath or an allopath. the peritoneum, the fibro peritoneum, covers the upper 2/3 of the rectum. So a good part of the rectum is behind the fibro peritoneum. Okay. And so as you look at it here, can you see where we are at? Here is the what is called your rectum is here, part of it, the other part is behind, and this is a female. So you have the uterus, the urinary bladder, appendix, cecum, ascending colon, and the flexure, and as you look at the transverse colon here, coming down. And so here, this here is the mesentery. In the inframesocolic compartment, right in the, more or less in the center, you have the mesentery. The mesentery is really kind of a formidable structure. It's very strong. Double layer of mesentery attached to the posterior abdominal wall, and at its tip, you have all the coils of the small intestine. And so the small intestine, you know, has been removed. Here you can see the jejunum, and here is the part of the, you know, ileum here. So the coils of the small intestine that you see has been removed, and what, you know, attaches and allows the small intestine to hang around, snoop around in the abdominal cavity is this mesentery, mesentery of the small intestine. So this has been cut. So the mesentery of the small intestine is sitting like this. It's like this, in this vertical position, you know, below the transverse mesocolon, that's attached to the posterior abdominal wall. Alright? By staying there, it is, you know, separating the inframesocolic compartment into, so one here is the, you can see right and left, you know, compartments here. That means this from here on up to here, and from here up to here, right and left, you know, inframesocolic compartments, right and left inframesocolic compartment. Do you need to know it is the right and left inframesocolic compartment? Yeah. But what you need to know is the clinical significance. What is the clinical significance? That's where I'm taking you here. Look at this inframesocolic compartment. And on the left side of the inframesocolic compartment, you can see free movement of free movement of fluid or anything into the pelvic cavity. There's freedom for it to move. Okay? On the other hand, if you look on the right side of the mesentery of the small intestine, that freedom of fluid movement is not there because of the arrangement or attachment of structures, you know, to the ascending colon here. So what should you know this? Why should you know this? The reason is, if somebody has an infection in the inframesocolic compartment, you may want to make your patient sit up so that there's fluid drainage, pus or fluid or whatever, blood or whatever. Draining can easily, from this side, it can easily drain into the pelvis. From where you can remove it, much better than you can from the abdominal cavity. And the other is, this word here is, I spelled it wrong yesterday when I was doing it. I'm so tired, I spelled it wrong here. It should be one word. Paracolic is one word. Okay? Paracolic flattish. That is something, a classical word, anybody can use it, ask you. On paracolic guttage. Paracolic guttage, allopaths, naturopaths, all physicians would hear it. So here is paracolic guttage, right here. Here, right paracolic gutter, the space between the ascending colon and the body wall, on the right side is the right paracolic gutter. The space between the descending colon and the body wall is the left paracolic gutter. The left paracolic first appendix. You can then imagine where can the exudate or struct can go. If it is the appendix here, it may be able to go much better into the pelvis because it is here. But if it is someplace here, the cecum and the ascending colon, it may not be as easily draining. Okay. So paracolic letters are deepest compartments of the peritoneal, you know, cavity in the supine position. When your patient is lying down in supine position, paracolic letters are the deepest compartments of the peritoneal cavity, except which other cavity can you think of from looking at this diagram? Which other cavity is deeper? The pelvic cavity, the pelvis and or the pelvic, you know, cavity. So paracolic letters I'm taking you through is not to torture anyone, to make sure you understand that in the abdomen you have these little compartments. And so here, when you look at this one here, this shows you, this is in the supplemental notes as well as in your following packet. So wherever you choose to look, you can see here. So that is the pelvic cavity. And so then you can see when you sit, make the person sit up, how the fluid from, you know, here it can drain into the pelvic, you know, cavity, and in terms of the depth, you know, also, which is, you know, the deepest, you know, cavity in supine, you know, position. So that's the paracolic letters. There's one more thing about the paracolic letters. From the paracolic letters, that means if you have pus or infected fluid or anything like that in the paracolic letters, do you think it can go into the supramesocolic compartment below the diaphragm? Do you think it can go from here into the supracolic compartment below the diaphragm? Yes, it can. It can travel. Okay, and it can travel, and you can develop what is called a diaphragmatic abscess. You can develop a sub diaphragmatic abscess. So that means, as an educated physician, you can figure out how it happens. And if you have an abdominal infection, how that abdominal infection, you know, can, you know, move into, you know, into the abdominal infection, can move into your subdiaphragmatic recess or, you know, space, and it can cause, you know, an abscess, so which can be referred to as the subphrenic, you know, phrenic referring to the diaphragm, subphrenic abscess, okay? And so that is how, you know, it can happen. Now, let me see. So that is about paracolic letters. That is about paracolic letters, okay? And then, let me see, the clinical significance of these paracolic letters, the inframesocolic compartments, is what I've been dwelling on in the last few minutes, okay? Now, the lesser sac or the omental bursa, we'll just finish this one and then we'll stop. We'll do the omenta later, and not today. But the lesser sac, because it's, I have colored it with you, so it's very easy to finish at the lesser sac, okay? And because that is somewhere, let's go and finish at this one quickly in 1 minute, just for the sake of finishing that one, you know, at a good place. So here, this green colored area is an irregular space that is called the lesser sac. that is the other, you know, subdivision of the word here, of the peritoneal, you know, cavity. And if you take a cross section of it here, right here, this shows you, when you look at the cross section here, here is the stomach. So here is the stomach in this diagram. Here's the stomach. See, behind that stomach, below the liver. So here is the stomach. Here's the pancreas. And so this is this closed irregular space behind the stomach. And it communicates. See, that's the communication into it. It communicates with the greater sac via what is called the ventral foramen, or the epiploid foramen, or the foramen of Winslow. This is the foramen. This foramen here. And that is the foramen that you see here in what color should I? I think I put the red color so you can really see. So here is that opening. After you take the liver out, or before you take the liver out, you will be able to put your probe of hand or your hand below the liver, you know, behind the stomach, and into this irregular space. What is the function of it? It allows expansion of the stomach. It allows expansion of the stomach. And its function is not all that, you know, good for us. That is, that's good function is it allows expansion of the stomach. The other function is internal herniation. Loops of small intestine can go into this place, can become strangulated. Okay? And so that is the function of it. That is the lesser, you know, sac. Greater sac is here, lesser sac is here. And the next day in class, we will go over the omenta, the greater omentum, lesser omentum. And I'd like you to use the outline and read intraperitoneal, all those, you know, ventral relationship of structures. And so we can move on to finish this one and move on.